House and in Congress, and modeling the actions we want our government to take. Again, that's Code Pink Radio, Thursdays at 11 a.m. on Washington, D.C.'s WPFW and New York City's WBAI, an engaging hour of cutting-edge conversation not to be missed.
We are women of the world. We're from the east, south, north, and west.
I'm Muiza Muntali, host of African Now, and you're tuned to member-supported WPFW Washington.
Welcome to On the Margin with E. Ethelbert Miller. My guest today is Gerald Early. Gerald Early is the author of Play Harder, The Triumph of Black Baseball in America. He's also the Merle Kling Professor of Modern Letters in the African and African American Studies Department at Washington University in St. Louis. How are you doing this morning?
I'm good. How are you?
Okay, we got a lot to talk about. We got to play catch today. Okay. First, this is a wonderful book. I just want to tell you that Play Harder, The Triumph of Black Baseball in America is a beautiful book. Let's begin to talk about this title. You know, you say that Play Harder is something black players actually said, people like Frank Robinson and Vic Power. Talk about the meaning behind this title.
The publisher wanted a title that was actually something that black players said, but it also had to be short. And so that was a little hard to find that. I discovered Play Harder by reading Jackie Robinson's book, Baseball Has Done It, his book about it, the integration of baseball, where he interviewed a whole bunch of black players and several of them used this expression, some variant of it. To me, what the expression meant was signaling overcoming adversity and playing baseball, and particularly the special adversity that black players had, but it also signaled a determination to not fail, which I thought was actually kind of inspirational. And so that was one of the reasons why I liked using it as a title for the book, because it was short, but I also thought it was inspirational.
It's also, you know, you could say, and I believe you might have said this in one of your lectures, it's a form of resistance, actually.
Mm-hmm. It is a form of resistance because it was players feeling they were encountering resistance in going into the major leagues and playing with whites, and they were determined that they weren't going to be defeated and they weren't going to let whites drive them out of the game or discourage them from playing the game. So it was a form of resistance.
Mm-hmm. You know, also in your book, you mentioned this physical and mental toll that it took. I mean, we could use Jackie Robinson as example, but I was wondering, were there other baseball players perhaps that maybe even dropped out, said, okay, I can't deal with this mentally? Or, for example, when I think of Jackie Robinson, I think he was probably able to do it because he had Rachel Robinson.
Rachel was very important for Jackie Robinson to survive what he was going through. There's no question about that. And she deserves all kinds of credit for helping him.
You got the wedding photo in the book.
But it was difficult, and the pressure was enormous, I think, for many players. And the thing is that did players not make it? Yeah, there were players who didn't make it. Let's look at somebody like Willard Brown and Hank Thompson, who played for the St. Louis Browns the same year that Jackie Robinson broke in 1947. The Browns had them for maybe a month or something like that. And Willard Brown, really, I don't think he wanted to make it. I mean, he was one of the great players of the Negro Leagues. He played very poorly when he got to the Browns. I don't think he really wanted to make it. I think he felt that the pressure and the isolation, it was tremendous isolation that black players had to endure, because the white players on the team would just totally not deal with them, would be alienating. And so it was very, very difficult. And I think that Willard Brown wound up going back to the Negro Leagues, where he did well. And I think it was a matter of the pressure of it and the alienation and saying, look, I don't want to deal with this. So I think that some people opted, in some ways, their performance showed, in some ways, they were choosing to opt out of integration because they didn't think it was worth it.
Okay, let's put you on the spot. So it's a choice that you have to make. You, Gerald Early, have to decide. The first person is going to be either Jackie Robinson or Satchel Paige.
Jackie Robinson, not that I don't have tremendous regard for Satchel Paige and what he was, but Jackie Robinson represented a certain kind of black manhood, and that was important to have represented as the first person breaking in. You know, you have to remember that Jackie Robinson got court-martialed in 1944 for not going to the back of a bus on an army base. He was given a medical discharge because the army was tired of dealing with him. And this is like, okay, this is our way to wash our hands, the whole thing, we'll give him a medical discharge. That's important to know about Jackie Robinson is the fact that he was an intense race man and he had intense racial pride. Satchel Paige had racial pride, no question, but it wasn't exhibited in the same way. He didn't have the same kind of persona that Robinson did. And I think that Robinson's persona was very important in breaking into, in having the first person break into the game. So I would say, yeah, between the two, yes, I would go with Robinson.
And, you know, some people would say that Satchel had a Kevin Hart personality.
Yes. Well, he did. I mean, he was I don't want to say comic, but he had a certain kind of approach to what he was doing. He was a showman. Let me put it like that. He was a showman. And what Robinson was this super serious athlete. There's no question that Satchel Paige was a very accomplished athlete. There's no question, one of the greatest pitchers ever. But this comic overlay, that this entertainer overlay that he had, was, I feel, not quite to the purpose for integration that Robinson had, being this very, very serious black man and this very, very serious black athlete. There was something about Robinson that brought a kind of racial pride to, and almost a sense of defiance to the whole thing about integration that I don't think Satchel Paige would have brought if he had been the first one.
Okay. Talk about how this book, Play Harder, is an outgrowth of a June 2020 meeting of consultants at the National Baseball Hall of Fame and Museum in Cooperstown. Why were you there? Who were some of the other consultants? You call them, I think, the Fab Five.
I've been asked to, the National Baseball Hall of Fame and Museum wanted to change their black exhibit. They had an exhibit on black baseball that had been up since the 1990s, and they felt it was dated and they wanted to change it. So they called in some people, including me, to help change it. I think one of the reasons I was chosen was because I was in Ken Burns' baseball documentary. So they said, oh, here's a black guy who's very prominent.
In fact, you're the only black guy in the room if I recall in that documentary.
So, I mean, I'm partly kidding because I've written some stuff about baseball, so I'm sure there was some other reason.
But you were the only black person in that room. I saw that documentary.
But, Roy Ricardo Phillips was also one of the consultants, a great poet, great writer, who's also working on a book about baseball.
He's at Stony Brook, I think, right?
Yes, that's right. Leslie Heafy, who is a woman historian working. She did a book on Negro League baseball. She's working on a book about black women in baseball. Larry Lester, Larry Lester is the leading expert on the Negro Leagues. I mean, the guy really is the dude on the Negro Leagues. And one of the founders of the Negro League Museum in Kansas City. And Rob Ruck, professor at University of Pittsburgh, and who had worked with the Hall before on their exhibit on Latino baseball, because the Hall has an exhibit on Latino baseball. So we were the people who were hired to help them do that. And it was in the process of helping them do that and rethink this exhibit and work the exhibit. The exhibit opened last May. It opened on Memorial Day last May. That's how the book project emerged, is from this exhibit. The idea was we would like to have a book that would accompany the exhibit.
Mm-hmm. You know, correct me if I'm wrong about these statistics. Black people, I believe, are only 3% of the visitors to Cooperstown. And I was wondering, why is that? Is it the location? And do you see your book as a way of promoting the black, promoting the Hall of Fame, actually?
Yeah, that came up in our meetings. It was concern among the people at Cooperstown that so few black people come up there. Part of it is the location. Probably if it was in New York City.
Wait a minute, brother. It was the only thing when you were trying to get to Canada. you know, wasn't Frederick Douglass living up there at one time? You know, Maybe why his family was a baseball fan. But you know what I'm saying? I can understand that excuse, but still, is it location? Is it what's there? Is it because people aren't interested in baseball?
It's a combination of several things. I think the location plays a role in it because it's, as I said, I think it was, if it were in New York City or something like that, more Black people would go to it. Part of it is location. It's off the beaten track. I mean, you really got to go out of your way if you want to go there. Mm-hmm. I think that also it partly is about Black people's engagement with baseball now. It's a signal about Black people's engagement with baseball now. And they clearly are not as engaged with this game as they once were. So that's another thing. And so I think it's this combination of these various elements, Black people's engagement with the game, the location of the museum, so forth, that play into this. So the Hall has wanted to get more Black people to come. I don't know if this exhibit would do that or if the book necessarily would do that, but I think it's important to make the engagement. And the thing that was impressive about when the exhibit opened, the thing that was super impressive about it, because I was there when it opened, was how many Black ex-ball players came. A ton of them came, and that was impressive.
Okay. You know, when I started reading your book, Play Harder, I started with the back, you know, I mean, I knew the stuff about Frederick Douglass. I knew that, so I started the back and I got pulled in with the stories about fathers and sons, you know, Barnes and Griffey. And then I started reading about Dwight Gooden and Darryl Strawberry. This is a big book. What are two or three stories that are your favorite?
One of the stories that really moved me was a story about Jackie Robinson and Rachel Robinson when they traveled to the first training camp in the South.
To Daytona, I think it was.
Right, to join the Dodgers. That's a story that always moved me deeply, what they went through just to get to the training camp. And it's a little bit cut in the book because it's actually longer detailed in the book about what they went through just getting there. So that's a story that really has always moved me tremendously. Hank Aaron breaking the home run record has, because I was in college when that happened. And that was a big deal for me. I mean, that was a huge deal when he broke the home run record. And I remember it very well. And that's a story that was a very important story for me as well. One of the other stories that's not as big, it may not strike people as big a deal, which I wrote about in the book, is Vida Blue. And Vida Blue's, when Vida Blue was having this super duper year and Charlie Finley wanted him to change his name to True Blue, which Vida Blue absolutely refused to do, and said, you know, this is my father gave me his name. This name is perfect. I'm not changing my name. And that was a story that when I found out about that story, I said, this is going in the book. I mean, I don't care that it's not as big a story as some of these other things, but this is going in the book because I think it's a tremendous story about this man and kind of the whole business of what his name is and for a Black person and how important that is.
And, you know, True Blue sounds something like a Richard Ralph Ellison character, like True Blood.
Yes. So, you know, Vida Blue thought it was True Blue. That's like a name of a dog or something. He was.
Well, that's back in the days of Rin Tin Tin, you know what I mean?
And so, you know, those are some of the stories that really were very important to me and affected me, you know, and I really wanted to make sure that they got in the book.
Well, let me ask you this as a writer, Gerald Early. When you think about, you know, Black baseball, especially, you know, the Negro League, there's so many anecdotes, stories. And like, how do you know all the stories are true? That was like a, you know, Che Bates. How do you know all the stories are true?
You don't know that all the stories are true, but a lot of the stories are good. Okay. And they're powerful and they tell you something. You begin to think that some of the stories are true, you hope, because I've read so many interviews with that Black Negro League players gave, and there was repetition. So you said, well, this got repeated a lot, so maybe this is probably true because so many people are repeating this story.
But you that's know, that's necessarily. That, but see, that's like, what's the sister? I think her name is Turner. About rumors, everybody said, "Yeah, I saw it on 60 Minutes." Yeah, no, but it wasn't on 60 Minutes. But you say you saw it on 60 Minutes. Everybody said they saw it on 60 right. Minutes.
So yeah, you can't. That's not absolutely a case of there's trustworthy just because so many people say it. But it has a certain kind of validity to it. It was powerful to get their testimony. Just about their experience of playing, even beyond whatever stories they may have been telling about, oh, Josh Gibson hit this 500-foot home run or anything like that. Right. Just the accounts they gave of the day-to-day grind of doing this and their commitment to doing it. That was the thing, is that this was not easy work. And these men were tremendously committed to doing it. And I think that was really inspirational. And that was really more powerful to me than any kind of stories they may have had about, oh, Satchel Paige just stay, he struck out 12 guys in a row or something like that. That's interesting, but just the daily grind of being committed to playing these games was more striking to me.
Did you have, I'm looking at your writing this book. Are you also selecting the photos to say, okay, I want to have this pictorial narrative also? Did you select the photos to go with certain places in the text?
No, I didn't select the photos. I had some discussion about photos, but I let the hall people pick the photos.
You sound like Duke Ellington saying, well, Billy Strayhorn wrote that.
Right. And the hall people had a very good idea of the photos they wanted to use. And, they showed me stuff as they were going along. And I said, oh, this is really good. And this is really good. So I really didn't have any complaint about the photos. In fact, I thought the photos were really powerful and made the book more striking that there were these photos in it and that there were so many photos that were in it.
Did you look at a photo and say, wow, there's something in this photo that now if I'm writing, I'm going to add because I looked at this photo? Did it affect your writing that way?
Yeah, I would say the photo on the cover of the book of Willie Mays sliding home. I'd seen that photo before. And I knew I wanted to write some stuff about Willie Mays, but I wanted to write something different about Mays than just saying, okay, he was this great player and so forth, which is why I decided to write the chapter about Willie Mays and his relationship with Latino ballplayers. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting about that is that at first there wasn't to be nothing said about Latino ballplayers in the book. The book was only supposed to be about Black American players. It was supposed to be nothing about Latino players. As I started writing the book, I told the people at the hall that's not going to work. that's not going to work because the Negro Leagues it was such a transnational type of thing with the Negro Leagues playing in Mexico, people playing in Cuba and so forth. And, Cuban and Mexican and other players playing in the Negro Leagues here, that's not quite going to work. So we're going to have something there about Latino players. that happened. And with that, I thought that I had an opening to talk about Willie Mays, and I wanted to talk about him in a certain way. And that photo, I just love that photo of him on the cover of the book. And I thought that talking about his relationship with Latino players was something that it's not new in the sense that no one knows about it. I just thought it was an angle that was a little bit different for this kind of a book to have people see him in that light.
Joe Early, talk about the importance of baseball during your childhood. You growing up in Philadelphia, talk about your mother and your aunt Lois and the importance of the Black fan in the history of baseball. And then Philadelphia and fans. And then I'm thinking about, maybe you could talk about Dick Allen and how he was treated.
Yeah. My mom was a big baseball fan, and she became a baseball fan, as many people did. She was a very young woman when Jackie Robinson broke in. My mom must have probably been about 19 or something when Jackie Robinson broke in. And she was crazy about Jackie Robinson. And she took my Aunt Lois, who was younger. They would go to ball games together to see Jack. They went to see Jackie Robinson play. They didn't go to see the Phillies play because they hated the Phillies. So they went to see Jackie Robinson play. And they would just go there. They would just scream their heads off. You know, there would be other black people there. They would just be screaming their heads off for the Brooklyn Dodgers. And every time Jackie Robinson came to bat, you know, I mean, Jackie Robinson hits a ground ball out. They hollered about that. You know, it was to hear that, to hear them talk about that was just amazing to me, how much he meant and how much he attracted them to baseball in a way, because he was out there in this particular arena playing it, that and was showing something to white people by standing up there playing this game. So I was very much taken by that. And I think that's probably among the things that made me a baseball fan, was how important it was to them, how important it was to older black people, the black guys, black barbers in the barbershop talking about the Negro leagues and all that kind of stuff. Baseball was much more, when I was a kid, baseball was much more ingrained in black culture than it is. That was much more talked about than it is now. And so and my grandfather was a huge fan of baseball. He took me to baseball games. And so that has a lot to do with my being a baseball fan, was that it was so ingrained in black culture at that time, I think much more so than it is now. So I was it was inevitable for me to be a baseball fan. I like playing the game too. Dick Allen was the first black superstar to come to Philadelphia. And Philadelphia is a place, you know, they talk about blue collar conservatism. Well, Philadelphia is a place that had a lot of blue collar conservatism, because Dick Allen went through a lot when he was in Philadelphia. He was a kind of moody guy, but the fact that he was a superstar player and he wanted, I think, certain kind of privileges and connection with being a superstar player, which is not unusual because most superstar players get certain kind of special considerations. I think kind of rubbed a lot of white fans the wrong way about, oh, why should he get these special considerations and all this? And you must remember, too, that this happened at the same time of the rise of Muhammad Ali in the 60s. And so there is this image of the black athlete at this point. Oh, they got a chip on their shoulders. They're this, that, and the other thing. Why can't they be like, you know, the old guys or something like that? So Dick Allen represented a new kind of black athlete, a new kind of mentality, along with somebody like Muhammad Ali and other kinds of people. So he had a tough tenure in Philadelphia. But interestingly enough, he came back some years later and played again for Philadelphia. But he had a tough tenure there in the 60s.
You know, I'm amazed by your childhood, because at one time I just thought you as a boxing guy, you know.
Boxing is also part of boxing was embedded in Philadelphia too. My wife is from Dallas, and she said, you know, black people in Philadelphia think black people in Philadelphia are tough. They some hardcore people in Philadelphia, man. She thought black people in Philadelphia were the toughest black people she ever met. Yeah, she said, y'all hard. She said, oh, that was the word. Black people in Philadelphia are hard.
Well, you know, when in your book, it's like, and I laughed at that because I believe they used to play in North Philadelphia. Now, you know, now I'm from New York. The worst thing that happened is that, you know, you come down from New York, going back to Howard University, and you decide, okay, I'm going to stop off and see some friends in Philly. But you get off at the North Philadelphia instead of the South. You know, that's like the worst place. But they moved the ballpark from there.
Right. They moved the ballpark from the Connie Mack Stadium, Shy Park, Connie Mack Stadium, where the Phillies play, was in North Philadelphia, 21st and Lehigh. And they moved the ballpark in 1970, ballpark move. Veterans Stadium moved way down in the South Philadelphia, way, 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 way down in South Philadelphia. So they moved it out of there.
That sounds like the moving of Griffith Stadium from by Howard University.
Yeah, Griffith Stadium was also in a black neighborhood. They moved that, yeah.
So this is where we know integration is coming. We move the ballparks first as opposed to the foul line. You know, before we take a break, I want you to, when I think about baseball, and we were mentioning, you know, Rachel Robinson, I'm also thinking a woman who gets overlooked a little is Billy Aaron, you know, who, and she started the Chasing the Dream Foundation. You know, I felt that she would also make a contribution. But you have two women in the book that I want you to talk about, and that's Effa Manley and also Toni Stone.
Yeah. Effa Manley was the wife of Abe Manley. They owned the Brooklyn Eagles that became the Newark Eagles. One of the famous players from the Newark Eagles was Larry Dolby, who integrated the American League. And Roy Campanella came from the Newark Eagles. So there was some famous black ball players came from the Newark Eagles. Effa Manley was probably the most outspoken Negro League owner by far. There's no question about she was the most controversial, the most outspoken. She was the person who criticized Jackie Robinson when Jackie Robinson went into the league. She criticized the major leagues for saying, you're not respecting us as a business, the Negro League owners and Negro Leagues, you're not respecting us as a business because you're just taking our players and you're not giving us any compensation for our players. And you wouldn't do that with any other league. You're talking about, oh, we can do that with your league because y'all really not organized baseball. Y'all not really, you know, y'all not for real business. And she stood up for the league. She stood up for her league in a way that was quite extraordinary. And she was really an extraordinary woman. And she's the only woman in the Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown, the only woman.
Are there any other women that would just been overlooked? Because many times we see people overlook. Is there any other black woman who was a business person associated with baseball?
There was C.T. Taylor's wife, who wound up owning, I can't remember the name of the team now, but my mind is blanking on it, wound up owning his team in the 1920s when he died. But she never became a real major force in the league. She wasn't the kind of voice in the league that Effa Manley became. The men owners really dominated the league. And it's really quite something that Effa Manley would, it was something that Effa Manley stood up against that male culture and, you know, told those guys, you know, where to get off and stuff like that. They said that she was a disruptor, a troublemaker. She was, and things like that, which is not unusual to say, well, a woman who's being very, very assertive, for men to say that about a woman who's being very, very assertive, which is what she was doing. Tony Stone, he also mentioned, Tony Stone was played with men in the Negro Leagues in the early 1950s. The Negro Leagues were really the ones that remained because Effa Manley's Negro National League folded when Jackie Robinson went into major, because when Jackie Robinson went into Major League Baseball, it took the black press and black fans with them. He took all of that with him. You know, it was like the Negro Leagues no longer existed. But, you know, there was a couple of Negro Leagues that battled on into the 50s. And in order to try to attract audiences, it was partly a novelty thing. They had Toni Stone, a black woman who had always played with men, who was very serious about playing baseball in the Negro Leagues in the early 1950s. Her career did not last. It ended after a couple of years. And that's unfortunate because the woman was so dedicated to playing baseball. And she was, you know, she wasn't a great player, but she held her own in playing with these men. But it was a sign as well, even though it was a kind of novelty thing, that black baseball had done something that was really path-breaking by having this woman out there playing. And and she had, the first year that she did it, she attracted huge audiences. I mean, lots of people came because they wanted to see this woman play. So lots of people came out, wow, I want to see this woman play with men. But she always wanted to play with men because she said, oh, I want to play the best. I want to play with the best. Because that's the only way I'm going to be good is if I play with the best, and the men are the best.
Well, I'm talking to one of the best right now, Joe Early. So I'm going to take a little break. My guest this morning is Joe Early. He's the author of Play Harder, The Triumph of Black Baseball in America. My name is Ethelbert Miller. The station is WPFW 89.3 FM.
This is your social justice calendar for the week of June 9th, 2025. Sunday, June 15th, 7 p.m., Gaza on Our Mind, a bi-weekly community gathering calling all artists, poets, and musicians in the DMV will take place at Sankofa Video and Books, 2714 Georgia Avenue, Northwest Washington, D.C. For more info and to RSVP, visit sankofa.com under the Events tab. WPFW's Social Justice Calendar connects you to grassroots activism in the DMV. Submissions can be emailed to socialjustice@wpfw.org. Please include the name, date, and address of the event. This is due by Thursday at 5 p.m. at least 1 week in advance of your event. WPFW's Social Justice Calendar helps build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Hey, we're back on the margin with my guest, Gerald Early, who is the author of Play Harder, The Triumph of Black Baseball in America. You know, Gerald, you mentioned Larry Doby, and there's one story I've said, I wish this story was in the book, because it's a story that I said I found fascinating. And that's the friendship between Larry Doby and Yogi Berra. Mm-hmm. You know, which I thought, did you know about that story, that relationship?
No, tell me about
because
it.
Because what happened is, I believe they became friends maybe around the same time that Doby came up. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe they were in the same, well, they might be from Montclair, New Jersey. Mm-hmm. But I think even an extension of the Yogi Berra Museum had a thing about Larry Doby. But there was friendship their entire life. And I said, wow, that's different than Pee Wee Rose putting his arm around Jackie Robinson. You know, and I didn't realize that. I don't know if it's in the, there's a book that came out, Larry Doby, The Struggle of the American Leagues, by Joseph Thomas Moore. Mm-hmm. So I don't know whether that, but I found that was a very interesting friendship. I want to get back to something. I have the book here. Mm-hmm. I'm going to my Bible, Quran. And you make a statement here, and I say, okay, I'm gonna raise this point. You have here, and we're talking about Filippo Lu.
Yeah.
And then I turn the page, and this is the paragraph. But Alou was right, despite the cultural interaction between African-Americans and players from Spanish-speaking areas south of the border. Much separated them, cuisine, language, the way they experience racism, the fact that Black Americans live in a white-majority country. To this day, dark-skinned Latinos don't generally self-identify as Black, and intermarriage between Blacks and Americans and Latinos is low. I said, Gerald, can you back that up?
Yeah, I mean... that information was gotten from, I forget what source it was, but it wasn't me.
You sound like Donald Trump in the White House with the president of South Africa, getting somebody gives him some clippings. It wasn't me. What? I'm just messing with you.
No, okay, man, that's a low.
No, come on. Let's play. We'll play with Tucker Carlson.
Oh, brother. that was something that, I can't remember the source right now, but there was a source for it. So it wasn't just me asserting that. In fact, the source for it, I was kind of surprised that it said that, but, it's backed up by the fact that many Black American players talk about the fact that, they feel, alienated from Latino players in part because of the language. Latino players will congregate with themselves and speak Spanish naturally. That's their first language. That's their native language. Most Black Americans, of course, don't know Spanish. And so they feel as though they're kind of on the outs with that because they don't speak Spanish. And I can understand a Latino player not necessarily wanting to speak English that much if English is your second language and you don't speak it that well. Naturally, you want to speak your own language. So that has been talked about in more than one place about this, the alienation that takes place between Latino players and Black American players on the basis of language. The other thing is, of course, that Black Latino players are not Americans. They're citizens of other countries, and they're here, I guess you could say, as guest workers in essence, because they go back home when the game is over. So their situation, they're looking at America and they're thinking about America is a little bit different than Black Americans are going to be thinking about America. What's an interesting thing? An interesting quote. Gary Sheffield made an interesting quote about Latino players when he was talking when some years ago when he was talking about how Latino players have become the dominant Black presence in Major League Baseball, which is good. That's undeniably true. And he said that he thought that happened because Black Latino players generally were easier for management to handle than Black American players. And I thought that was an interesting observation for him to make. I don't have anything to back it up. I don't have anything to back up his assertion with. I mean, that's his assertion. I just thought it was an interesting assertion that he made about why Black Latino players have become so dominant. I would think that part of it would have been related to the fact that at least for a certain time, Black Latino players were cheaper. I think he might have been suggesting that because they were cheaper at one point, they were easier to manage. And also because they were from another country and they were here on visas, that they would be easier to manage. So part of that actually makes some sense.
But see, what I took a different approach, Gerald. I took approach in terms of, you say Latinos. I started breaking it down. I said, are you Puerto Rican? Are you Cuban? Are you from Venezuela? Because, I the same way, for example, I'm talking about the West Indies. I'm not going to confuse people from Trinidad with Jamaica or Barbados. I'm not going to say Bob Marley is from Barbados. Okay. And so what happens is that we have this lumping. And I'm thinking of somebody like, say, Roberto Clemente, who definitely looked up to Willie Mays, depending on where you came from. Sure. Or I could look at New York. I remember, for example, when Puerto Ricans would say, okay, I'm a member of the Young Lords because I want to be a member of the Black Panther. But there was a consciousness because they were Puerto Ricans. Sure. Then you could have somebody who, is Venezuelan, or just say Cuba, where people say, okay, people think of Cuba and they think of Fidel Castro. No, you got some Black Cubans, right. Sure. And so that becomes a thing. And I'm bringing it up today because what I find interesting on the Washington Nationals today, you got Garcia, who's a second baseman, and Abrams, who's a shortstop, right, who's African-American. Right. And he says, I'm learning Spanish.
Right. I read that about CJ.
CJ's learning. And somebody did a thing like who in the Nationals speaks the best Spanish. And he's on the top. Right. And I said, that's amazing, because this is the type of friendship that I feel is key. Now, I want to go back to something at the beginning of the last half hour, at the end of the last half hour. I want to ask you about the Negro Baseball Leagues, and say, you, Gerald Early, based on your knowledge of the Negro Baseball League, you are now Japanese. Are you concerned about what might happen to the Japanese League? Because Shohei, Ichiro, you have key Japanese players coming to the United States. What's going to happen to the Japanese Baseball League? Are they protecting themselves differently?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think it's a different thing because, Japan, we're talking about a whole separate and different country. We Black people in America have always operated basically as a kind of colonized people within this country. And the rise of Black baseball was the rise of a baseball of a colonized people. And what happened with it ultimately, insofar as taking players and everything, what happened was that it was the weakness of the business, the weakness of colonized people in this country trying to sustain that business, and the fact that Major League Baseball did not have to respect it as a business, which they did not respect it as a business, that made the whole structure collapse. There isn't any possibility, even with these players coming over here, these Japanese, that Japanese baseball, the structure of it is going to collapse. And that's the difference.
Yeah. You talk about that, and you made a reference to it. Let's go back. You just made one reference to it in the beginning of the show. Talk about the Mexican League that started in 1940, because that sort of folded also.
Yeah, that folded too. The Mexican League, the idea behind it, the Mexican League offered integrated baseball before they had integrated baseball in the United States. And the thought was behind it that this was the future of baseball. What the Mexican League was saying, we're giving you what baseball is going to be. It's going to be Latino people, and it's going to be Black American people, and it's going to be white American, because they also recruited white American players. Now, the major leagues had more power to prevent their players from jumping by saying, if you jump, we're going to ban you forever. If you jump over here, you go do that. And so that made a lot of guys in the white major leagues think twice about wanting to do that, because they wanted to have the option of coming back in cases.
They jump back.
Right, jump back. Now, black teams threatened the same thing when Josh Gibson and other people jumped over there, Willie Wells and people like that. They threatened the same thing. They couldn't back it up in the same way because they needed those guys and they couldn't back it up. So the guys might lay out for a year or something like that, but they would come back because they couldn't back it up. It's the same way with the reserve clause. Now, major leagues had the reserve clause, which prevented a player from just saying, I'm going to sell myself to any team. You know, my contract with you is over and I'm going to, you know, I'm up for bid. You know, y'all bid on me. Now, the reserve clause prevented that from happening. What now we call today free agency. They prevented that from happening. Now, the black teams had the same clause. They had the same kind of contract. They had the same clause in there about reserve clause. They could not enforce it. They couldn't stop the players from jumping to other teams and stuff like that. Was always a big problem with Negro League baseball, was players jumping to other teams. Satchel Paige did it religiously, just jumping for different teams who ever offering more money. And that was a big problem because the league couldn't enforce it because they couldn't afford to punish the players in the way that the major leagues could do. They couldn't afford to do that. And they didn't have the muscle behind them to be able to do that. So so they had to operate differently. And in this way, the players, I wouldn't say the players have more power. The players weren't as controlled by the teams. It wasn't that the teams didn't want to control the players in that way. They couldn't. And that made a difference in how the Negro Leagues operate. But despite all of this, the Negro Leagues were able to operate fairly well and, in fact, made money for several years during World War II. The Negro Leagues were quite profitable. Mm-hmm.
Talk about the technology changing. You know, at one time, people listened to baseball on the radio. And then all of a sudden now, here comes baseball on television. And now, for example, we're dealing with the streaming. Talk about the influence of that on audience and then also, I guess, on owners making money.
The more ways you can get a baseball game to people other than people just having to attend the game, you open up more possibilities for revenue for the team because it's in essence what you're doing is licensing the game in various platforms. So it started out with radio and then with television, now with streaming and the like. So you got different platforms for licensing stuff, for licensing the game, and so you can extend the audience. What was very short-sighted about baseball in the beginning about this was that they thought they were going to lose people coming to the game if they were able to hear it on the radio. Oh, they'll be able to hear it on the radio for free, so they won't come to the games. Actually, they're not hearing on the radio for free because you got advertisers and commercials and stuff like that. So they're not hearing it on the radio for free. They aren't watching on television for free. And they certainly are not watching on television for free now. They weren't watching it on television for free when you had non-paying, you know, non-cable television or something like that. But they aren't watching it for free now anyway. So it was never really a thing of watching it for free. And television has paid, television contracts to broadcast baseball games have always been lucrative for baseball. Those platforms have been helpful in giving streams to baseball. And those were streams that with radio and so forth that black baseball was not able to exploit in the way that white baseball could. White baseball just had more leverage and more connections to be able to do that. And black baseball wasn't able to do that. But those revenue streams have made it possible for professional baseball today to pay players a certain amount of money because of the money that they're able to gain from these various streams and these various ways of being able to present the games to people. You know, having people come to the park, that's so 19th century way of thinking about how you're going to make money from a game. You're thinking about making money from a game by reaching millions of people who will never set foot in a park.
Hey, talk about Gerald, if we move towards the end of our show, talk about the role that the various commissioners, baseball commissioners, have, especially when it comes to issues of race.
Well, you know, the commissioners have been important. Kennesaw Mountain Landis, who became commissioner when as a result of the Black Sox scandal in 1919, became commissioner. he was pretty determined that there wasn't going to be any integration in baseball. Really, integration in baseball didn't happen until after he was no longer the commissioner of baseball. And Happy Chandler became commissioner, and it happened under him and not under Mountain Landis. And commissioners were very important in how the game was run. Landis had a lot of power, and he used his power in very interesting ways with baseball. One of them was to prevent, one of them was about gambling, one of them was about the integrity of the game. It was important for baseball not to be blemished in the way some other sports were. It was important for baseball to always have a certain kind of image about it as not being a game that's compromised in any way by in any way people thinking it was fixed. That was the thing that always marred boxing. That was the thing for a while that marred college basketball, was the idea of stuff being fixed. So baseball was very determined that it wasn't going to have the image of the of any kind of possibility of people thinking games were fixed. So it had this image of wanting, you know, integrity of the game, you know, the integrity of the game was very important. So, you know, over time, you know, that the commissioners have a lot of power, and it was because of a certain commissioner that integration happened. Integration, how baseball was able to expand has a lot to do with commissioners. The platforming of baseball has a lot to do with commissioners. What has happened over time with the power of commissioners is that it has been challenged by the rise of the power of the players' union. Mm-hmm. Players' union was not particularly strong or anything. Players got more militant starting in the 60s about wanting to have a stronger union. And then, of course, with Marvin Miller coming on the scene, players had really gotten serious. We feel that the owners are jacking us around, and we want to get serious. So. Mm-hmm. The players union now became a serious power to counteract the owners and be able to have influence with the commissioner. And so then you got to kind of cut this three-headed monster with baseball, with the commissioners, the owners, and now the players union. So the commissioner still has power. The commissioner does not have as much. The commissioner is not as strong as the commissioner used to be. In the sense of somebody like a Kennesaw Mountain Landis who had enormous power. But the commissioner is still a very important voice. For instance, under Bud Selig, we got interleague play under Bud Selig because that was something that was important to him and so forth. Interleague play probably meant more at the time when the leagues had two different rules and one league had a DH and one league and the other league didn't. Now that everybody got a DH, it's kind of, the leagues have become kind of homogenized in a sense that everybody got a DH. But the interesting thing is that all during this time, and it's been raised that there was never been a black commissioner. And there was talk at one point that Bill White, who had been the president of the National League, would become the commissioner. He didn't. Bill White left baseball a very bitter man.
Yeah, I think it was this time his book was Uppity, I think. Was it?
Yes, he left baseball a very bitter man. And he has nothing good to say about the, he has very little good to say about the structure, the business structure of baseball, the administrative structure of baseball, he has very little good to say about. But baseball has to be understood not as a business and the administrative structure of how it's run. And the commissioner is still a very important office. And how baseball's run.
I'm gonna tie you to your city, in terms of you know St. Louis, in terms of the Bob Gibsons. You know, talk about the, how unique St. Louis has been and the Cardinals in terms of black baseball. I'm thinking of Lou Brock and Gibson. And those
yeah, players. St. Louis was a team that when it emerged, when St. Louis emerged as a powerful team in the '60s, they had some key black players who became. Many of them wound up in the Hall of Fame, like Lou Brock, like Bob Gibson. Bill White was on the team at that time in 64 when the team beat the Yankees. Kurt Flood, who turned out to be extremely important in the history of baseball.
Traded for Dick Allen, I think. Traded for Dick Allen.
Traded for Dick Allen. Yes, traded for Dick Allen. He turned out to be very important in the history of baseball. Beyond the playing field, I mean, Kurt Flood will go down in history as very important just beyond the playing field. And And his act of resistance, we talked about resistance earlier. I mean, clearly what he was doing in challenging baseball and the reserve clause is clearly an act of resistance. And the way he framed it, like, I don't, you know, making an analogy between being under the reserve clause and slavery, just really set a certain kind of tone for how people were seeing that moment of, mm-hmm. of this challenge with baseball. So the Cardinals had these players on the team that turned out to be key star players, several of whom made the Hall of Fame. And it was a team that got along well. Those guys got along pretty well at that time. They got along better than some people, some black and white players did on some other teams. And the team was enormously successful. So it was a very groundbreaking. That was the 60s Cardinals, but it was a very groundbreaking team. And then they added Orlando Cepeda. So they had this kind of Latino mix in 67 and 68 with adding Orlando Cepeda. And so it was a very...
You know what? I'm going to interject because you were talking about, we were talking about black Latinos. Now we have this situation between Johnny Roseboro and Juan Marichal.
Oh,
if you want to talk about the conflict.
Yeah, that was... Yes.
Not getting along.
Yes, yeah, that was a very famous incident where Juan Marichal hit when he was batting. This is back in the days when pitchers batted. Hit Juan Marichal with John Roseboro over the head with a bat.
I want to end on a more positive note, Gerald. That's my last question. I'm going to put you up here. I'm going to make this connection that you, Gerald Early, are the equivalent to Wendell Smith.
Just talk about
Wendell Smith, and we go out on that note.
Wendell Smith was a great, great black sports writer, Pittsburgh Courier. He was a tremendous sports writer. He wrote about particularly black baseball for years. He was instrumental. He was one of the movers and shakers behind the integration of baseball. He was a companion of Jackie Robinson when Jackie Robinson first broke in. The first book that was written about Jackie Robinson was written by Wendell Smith. I mean, there have been several, you know, Jackie Robinson biographies / autobiographies, and Wendell Smith wrote the first one. Wendell Smith was around in the age when Willie Mays was huge and all this kind of stuff. So Wendell Smith, there were several black guys, black sports writers, good ones, important ones, but Wendell Smith would be the dean. Yeah, for you to say that about me, that is a huge compliment.
That's how we're gonna end the show, okay? I'm gonna put you up there in the Hall of Fame too.
Thank you. I admire Wendell Smith tremendously, so I thank you.
Okay. My guest today has been Gerald Early. Gerald Early is the author of Play Harder, The Triumph of Black Baseball in America. He's also the Merle Kling Professor of Modern Letters in the African and African American Studies Department at Washington University in St. Louis. My name is E. Ethelbert Miller. The show's On the Margin. The station's WPFW 89.3 FM.
I'm Robin Holden.
And this is Miyuki Williams.
The Jazz and Justice Festival happens Sunday, June 22nd, from noon until 8 p.m.
Presented by WPFW in collaboration with Washington Parks and People, the event is an activation of music, poetry, social justice teach-ins, elder circle, visual arts, wellness, children's activities, and more. It takes place in Malcolm X Park and the Josephine Butler Center, located at 16th and Euclid Streets Northwest.
Performers in the park include Saiz Kamaladeen, Kaba Soul Singer, The Silked Trio, Lady Murr, and the Proverbs Reggae Band.
There will be musical sets by DJs Abby, Lance Reynolds, Rita Burns, Willard, and Underdog.
In the Josephine Butler Center, there'll be short documentary screenings curated by Jordan Strudwick an art exhibition created by Adrian Ferguson of the Art of Noise Gallery, and a community tea presented by Milani Douglas.
The Jazz and Justice Festival, an afternoon of joy and resistance, Sunday, June 22nd, noon until 8 p.m. Details at WPFWFM.org.
WPFW.
Building a better world.
One broadcast at a time.
The 2025 Home Rule Music Festival opens Friday, June 13th with a dynamic youth musical showcase at Woolly Mammoth Theater, highlighting the next generation of go-go and jazz artists. Then, on Saturday, June 21st, the festival continues with a live performance by Backyard Band and Plucky and the Oneness of Juju, and other standout artists representing go-go and jazz. The festival also includes live DJ sets, record fair, vendors, and community activities. Details at homerulemusicfestival.com.
Do you know what time it is?
Do you know?
Do you know what time it is?
Yeah. Come on, come on, come on.
To the east, my brother, to the east.
To the east, my brother, to the east. Come on.
To the east, my brother, to the east.
To the east, my brother.
Education, art, health, music, politics, and all things community.
Yes.
Join me, Ambrose Lane Jr., as we uncover the issues of DC communities east of the river on To the East, Mondays at 5 p.m. right here on your station for Jazz and Justice, WPFW 89.3 FM.
Greetings. WPFW is pleased to announce the relaunch of our major donor program, now known as the Jazz and Justice Circle. If you gave $1,000 last year or so far this year, you are automatically enrolled in this cherished group of listener members, and we thank you. Benefits of your membership are at WPFWFM.org under the Support Us tab at the top of the homepage is the Jazz and Justice Circle. Interested in joining this select group? Please consider a donation of $1,000 or more online at WPFWFM.org. Your donation helps WPFW build a better world one broadcast at a time.
Freedom!
June is Caribbean American Heritage Month. Thus, CAWI, CPN, ICS, AFI, and Africa World Now Project present the 23rd DC Caribbean Film Fest, June 6th to June 12th, at AFI Silver Theater and Cultural Center in downtown Silver Spring. The festival showcases the best in Caribbean cinema with films such as the U.S. premiere of Fanon and more. The DC Caribbean Film Fest, June 6th to June 12th. Information at afi.com/silver or 301-495-6700. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Wondering how to get WPFW swag in your life? Items that say, I support Jazz and Justice without saying a word. We've got you covered. Details and browsing at WPFWFM.org. Again, that's WPFWFM.org.
This is Rev Yearwood, and I am so excited to announce our new climate show, Think 100% Climate Friday. This show will keep you up to date on everything climate justice related in a rapidly changing world. We will discuss breaking news and updates on environmental issues, the climate crisis, COVID-19, and politics. This show will make tangible how the climate crisis is already impacting our lives and what you can do about it. So tune in every Friday at 9 o'clock a.m. right here on WPFW 89.3, your jazz and justice station.
Are you in the process of writing or updating your will, trust, or estate plan? We invite you to consider adding WPFW as a beneficiary through a charitable bequest. Bequests can take many forms and are usually the largest and most impactful gift a donor will ever make. Your bequest will help to ensure the programming WPFW has provided for almost 50 years will continue into the future. More info available by email at plannedgiving@w